I think I'm excited to finally get to the point where I open an app or I go to a website and I don't have any idea that crypto is underneath. I can pay with whatever options I want. And I think that'll be one of the requirements to get over this kind of user demand hurdle.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Thank you all for joining, and thank you to the Boston DAO and ETH Boston for having us. This is event has been great so far. And welcome to the FCAT Crypto Brief, doing it live today. Just to give us, some introductions, I'm Max Waddington.
David Shapiro.
Jack Newrider.
And I'm Parth.
So the FCAT Crypto Brief podcast originally started as an internal webinar where we kind of grouped together a bunch of minds across Fidelity just to have fun, a fun conversation and talk about crypto. And it evolved into a podcast. And sometimes we'll talk about kind of news and events, if it's a big week for that. Other times we'll dive deep into a bigger topic or theme. And that's what we plan on doing today. We're going to dive as deep as we can into tokenization. And I think these guys have some really awesome insight into that. So I hope everybody's able to take something out of this and have a fun conversation. But I guess before we dive into that topic, how are we all feeling with ETH Boston? Give me some raw reactions.
Well, first of all, thank you all for wandering back right after lunch. So that's a big dub. I just want to make sure that this is not a panel. It's supposed to be super fun, casual, good vibes. So we'll be talking about our opinions. But I think I love the vibes here. I think when you think about ETH Boston, it's just so grassroots driven. You're not being chased by vendors. People are not trying to sell you products. It's just so it's builder first, and that's the fun part about coming back to ETH Boston. I do have to say it's a really interesting shift. But I remember when I did ETH Boston two years ago, and or even the MIT Bitcoin Expo, which was in 2016. A lot of people used to wear a sweatshirt and shorts. And I'm actually now kind of embarrassed at myself that I'm wearing a shirt and a pants. So you can see how crypto has also has now gotten mainstream and also a bit institutionalized, which is different.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think one of the things, which I think is a good sign, is I haven't heard anybody mention token prices. We have Bitcoin trading, you know, above 100,000. I guess I'm the first to do it. And I think that's a good sign. We have, you know, a pretty decent crowd here today that I've seen, and a lot of people just talking about, you know, projects or things that they're working on that they're passionate about, and about the actual like infrastructure and technology, and not just like number go up, which is, I think, a positive sign.
Yeah. So this is my first Boston Blockchain Week and first ETH Boston. And I got here about an hour ago and got into town last night, but so far, so good.
Nice. Awesome. And just a quick friendly reminder that this podcast, everything we say today, is just for educational purposes. None of it is legal, finance, tax, other advice.
No life advice, too.
No life advice. Sorry, guys. But yeah, I guess we can dive right into it. Tokenization is kind of the big theme. There's one kind of huge question I really want to get to the heart of, but maybe we start off with some context, kind of level set everyone. Can you guys just help me or help the audience and everyone understand what is tokenization? And I guess a big question I often hear is, why are we using blockchain here, right? Why is blockchain a big part of this?
Yeah, so tokenization is, it's really just the act of creating tokens, and those can represent anything from a stock to a collectible to a native crypto asset.
Yeah. And what I want to do is maybe just do a quick backstory to provide some context. I know we hope this doesn't come out to be just another tokenization podcast or panel, because that's the last thing in the world that you would want. I remember tokenization became mainstream in 2018, 2019. In fact, FTX was, you know, infamously using tokenized stocks as part of their FTX trading platform. And so tokenization has been around for a while, but it does feel different. Like, you kind of get your spidey senses on now, because it just feels that you have big companies like Robinhood, SoFi, or even big crypto exchanges like Kraken now starting to offer tokenized securities. So 2023, 2 years ago, tokenized money market fund was just a fun, small experiment. Now it's $7.5 billion as of today. So it does feel more real as opposed to when it was more conceptual a few years ago. And maybe some might ask, well, what's the reason now? Why is a company like Robinhood or SoFi going into it? And I think there's two reasons, and I'd love to hear your perspective on both sides. One is from an institution standpoint, for the person, for the institution that's offering those services, you capture some of those margins by using, by essentially tokenizing. You are not exactly getting rid of the underlying technology that we've been using for the last, since the 1970s, but essentially you do capture a lot of the margins just in terms of being more efficient and building a more of an efficient system. So imagine if you are, you know, if you are a company like Robinhood or SoFi, and you put 10% of your flow using tokenized securities, those are some notable gains just in terms of the fee that you capture. On the other side, as a user, you see private markets are obviously have become so much more valuable. In fact, I was reading this yesterday, but there was, or 2 days ago, that there's more ETFs in the public market than individual stocks. Right. So you can see that there's, you know, a lot of these companies like OpenAI, Stripe, SpaceX, they're all intentionally staying private. And retail just wants exposure. I mean, they're kind of sick of trading meme coins. And so, I don't know, maybe private markets are next. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think, so I'm on the venture side of the house, I guess, investing in early stage crypto projects. And we've spent a lot of time looking at tokenization. It does seem like there's a little bit of a bifurcation in terms of like, what assets have been tokenized thus far, and like, what's the narrative on tokenization? I think the narrative has been like, oh, we're going to tokenize alternative assets, private equity, private credit, things that are harder for people to access today, at least in developed markets, I think. And that has been like an interesting idea. And there's been a lot of investment in that space. And I think there's merit there. But at the same time, if we look at like what actually has traction, it's actually just access to like the US dollar via stablecoins. And so like there's $300 billion of stablecoins from, you know, Tether and Circle and other issuers, money market funds. And then like we're starting to see public equities be tokenized. And in the US, the value prop is, I would argue, for the average person, less strong, less relevant. Like, people will say, well, I have Visa and MasterCard today, I don't really need stablecoins. I think that's a valid point. But we actually spend a lot of time looking at like companies in emerging markets that are helping just people that live in like economies that have currencies with higher rates of inflation be able to just access dollars and be able to transact in dollars, or trade finance companies be able to transact in dollars and hold their wealth in dollars. And so we are starting to see like the beginnings of tokenization unlocking like real world capabilities in the financial system. Whereas, you know, crypto has built all of this financial markets infrastructure, but a lot of it has been on like circular, you call it like Ponzi-nomics, of these like tokens that have governance capabilities, but no real revenues, and you could borrow against them, but nobody knows what anything is really worth, versus like now we're actually bringing assets that have like underlying cash flows and like using those core financial primitives of being able to trade assets and send them and borrow and lend against them. And I think that's like where this starts to become like sustainable to some degree, which requires tokenization.
And I think that's the most critical piece here. Early on, we felt that it was the Wild West in terms of tokenization of products, and you didn't see a lot of market traction, not clear demand. But I see what's happening now is if you do, and I think you're right, when you look at an average US investor, you know, that person might say, well, what's the exact benefit to me? I know the institution gets a benefit, but to me, it's still the same product. But I still think we haven't explored the ideas around, well, if you have a tokenized security, can I use that as a collateral and get liquidity? Or even just new financial products like PERPs, perpetual futures. And if you, you know, and not that I'm suggesting that, but, you know, on the on-chain economy, you can, you know, move the slider all the way up to 20x, 100x, as opposed to on your brokerage, you can go only 2x. But the average investor would think about, well, what's the benefit that I'm getting from a tokenized security?
Yeah, one of the things like in the venture world that we talk about a lot, and it's like maybe a little cliche, is like the product has to be 10 times better than the incumbent product for anybody, like the average person to care. Like maybe we up here care about the fact that, like, you know, you can get better portfolio margin and in DeFi if you tokenize these equities. Those are like marginal gains and like operational efficiencies that, you know, some of the companies that are issuing can get. But in terms of like actual traction that we're starting to see, it's where's the product 10 times better? It's in the place that like has capital controls and people just can't access dollars. And like for the foreseeable future, I think that's where I'm like most bullish on the real world impact of tokenization. But I do think like the longer world view that we probably all share, I don't want to speak for us, is like we're going to continue to see this trend of tokenization of impact both emerging markets and developed markets and probably proliferate across asset classes.
Yeah, I kind of see two sides of the tokenization story so far. There's the businesses who are engaged in tokenizing, and then there's users who are actually engaging with these assets. And when it comes to the businesses, I think that Base sort of rewrote the story where everybody was seeing the amount of sequencer fees that are bringing in and started to think, okay, well, maybe we can drive revenue from tokenizing on our own chains or on our own networks. And you've seen this happen with the launch of Tempo. Stablecoins are tokenization. But when it comes to the user side of things, I think it's mostly an outside the United States thing. So a lot of people who are interested in these assets is because they can't access them otherwise. And so that's why we've seen the most successful tokenized assets be things like dollars and treasuries so far. And I kind of expect the other giant, super liquid, high volume assets to also find success being tokenized on chain, like the FANG stocks and things like that.
I remember in 2021 or 2022, I remember buying a car, and I for the deposit, you know, you could go through the car dealership or pay an interest of 6.5 or 6.75, whatever that was, or you could use some of the ETH and, you know, get liquidity from a lending protocol like Aave to get USDC out, which gets exchanged as cash when you use Coinbase. So I think there's like, it's one of those things where when once you actually use it, that's when you realize, wait a second, this just blew my mind. It's so much easier. And sure, it makes the UX is fantastic, maybe for crypto natives, but the end state or the hope is that it becomes, the end user doesn't even know that it's happening on crypto rails.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that David just mentioned was like, you have Base, you have Tempo, you have, I don't know how many L2s on Ethereum. But like for the average person, I think at the moment, like there's obviously a lot of things that need to happen on the UX front. And maybe like things like Intents fix that, where you can, you know, transact across these blockchains and just basically like state your intent, and then solvers will be able to like automatically help you move from one fragmented asset on a fragmented chain to another fragmented asset on another fragmented chain within the EVM.
And you know what's funny, because that goes into one of the most discussed topics, which is interop, right? So right now you see fragmentation of data, and you have capital parked in different silos. And I was thinking about this, when you think about, you know, but buying real estate or doing any kind of normal real world finance, you kind of have to go and use different systems on the back end. So you're using a fixed protocol for securities moving from one side to another. There's back offices to make sure that there is correct recon. On the other side, you're using fixed protocol for securities, but you're also using Swift for payments, for settlement. And so I think maybe DeFi is actually that interop layer for traditional finance. So we keep talking about, well, there's a need for interop across these different fragmented liquidity, but maybe this is the answer to the interop issue in traditional finance. I don't know.
It is like one of the most cited issues, especially in the ETH community. So I think that's super interesting. On that point, since we are at an ETH conference, how are you guys viewing like the RWA trend impacting ETH specifically? I know, Jack, you mentioned there were a bunch of solutions that could improve and accelerate that trend. But how are you viewing that now, especially given the fact that stablecoins took over, you know, 5 to 7 years to really get to where we are today, and considering that we're still pretty early innings in this trend? How do you guys think about that?
I mean, I think network effects matter. And like, it's obvious, like when issuers go to issue a token, quite often Ethereum mainnet is the first place that they go. And like, why do they do that? Because it's, you know, because of network effects of users, because it's, you know, the largest network by TVL. And it's like sort of the de facto place that you just go to issue initially. But I think like increasingly we're starting to see competition in particular on obviously like the stablecoin front of like smaller, cheaper, faster payments. And even within the Ethereum ecosystem on L2s themselves. I don't know if anybody has a great answer of how they foresee that playing out. But
well, I think the benefit of using something like ETH is that a lot of the core infrastructure is already built out. And so it's a great way to get adoption. So if I'm starting out with a stablecoin now, hypothetically, I make, you know, USDP, USD Parth, or whatever you want to call it. The one part which I don't have to worry about is think about a lending protocol, think about a market, think about a DEX. All of those things, that, you know, a classic example is Coinbase rolled out a product where you can do Bitcoin-backed loans. Right now, if you have Bitcoin on Coinbase, they didn't go and build a lending market. They're using Morpho on the back end, which is a DeFi protocol. So the fun part of, and the essentially the benefit of this is that you have composability, and that's extremely relevant in ETH because you have, it's kind of, in a sense, withstood the test of time when you think about a lot of these big DeFi protocols. So that infrastructure is built out already, and that's the benefit that institutions and new companies building out products get. It's just faster go to market.
And to me, that kind of seems like a flywheel a bit. And that's why we kind of see network effects often just run away, because you're building blocks on top of building blocks, right? So I think that's pretty interesting. I would hate for our compliance folks to be mad at me for not talking about the risks, maybe risks to the trend of RWAs, maybe taking longer than stablecoins, or it's kind of counter to your point, Parth, but like, how are you guys thinking about the risks here?
There's a lot of risks, and maybe I can go into one. We can actually talk about one each, because I think we could do this round twice if you do one risk each. But the first one that I foresee is the state of smart contract security even now is fairly nascent. Like, you still do a lot of manual auditing. There's humans in the loop. A lot of that process, I was listening to the panel right before in the morning focused on security. You kind of have to understand what's the scope of the smart contract audit that you just did. It's not just a certificate that you can show and say, well, here's how it's done. So smart contract security is, I think, a big risk. And I do foresee, as much as we have a lot of optimism now, I think there's going to be a few experiments which are not going to go well. And so that kind of might dip the sentiment around tokenization, but I think it's just important for us to embrace that. I just feel like we're just, from a smart contract auditing security standpoint, we're not there yet.
I would say sort of relatedly is the reliance on oracles. Like, when you converge between an inherently digital world, like if you're on Aave and you're borrowing against, you know, a digitally native asset, it's less of an issue. But if it's a tokenized asset and you're relying on an oracle provider to feed you in, you know, what the price of that asset is in real time, and your risk parameters are set as a result of that, I guess that also exists with digitally native assets too. But the reliance on oracles and the fact that like oracle vulnerability and manipulation and reliance on a single party to give you the source of truth that melds like the real world with this on-chain world, and the fact that like those risks within a protocol are sort of being socialized by the users of that protocol, I think that is increasingly a risk that like has to be dealt dealt with and understood.
And what's interesting is you don't see a lot of Oracle providers, right? It's just the three or four. Like, how many of us know maybe five other Oracle providers outside of the top two or three?
Yeah.
So it's a big risk.
Yeah, I would say custody and custodian risk. So as far as custody risk goes, I work on self-custody, and you know, it's possible to lose your keys and lose access to your assets. And when it comes to something like stablecoins, you know, if you lost a material amount, you might be able to call up the issuer and say, hey, like, I lost the keys to the coins in this wallet. Can you cancel them and issue me some new ones? But for like native assets, obviously you don't have that type of recourse. When it comes to custodian risk, stablecoins again seem pretty safe. You know, under Genius, these entities will be audited. But when it comes to other things like maybe gold-backed tokens, you know, there's a little bit more trust involved there, that all the gold that's backing the tokens is actually in the vaults. I don't know if we have as robust of systems to, you know, like audit gold vaults and things like that.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I think to piggyback on that, I hear kind of one of the main benefits or opportunities of tokenization being, you know, the impact to accessibility, right? That's probably one of the core reasons I think Jackie mentioned for stablecoins becoming so accessible is, or so impactful is because of their accessibility, right? So I hear that as like a bullish case. And you'll often hear them quote, hey, there's 5 billion people with internet access. So that's like kind of the upside. But then I kind of think back to conversations I've had and like how many people, like, want to deal with that hurdle of private key management, to your point, right? If the product isn't 10x better, or the, you know, getting access to this new tokenized product isn't 10 times better than what they're experiencing now, are all 5 billion of those people going to deal with private key management and do it in the right way? So I guess that would be a risk to kind of like the addressable market or the upside to accelerate this trend.
Max, that's such a good point, because when you think about these products, a lot of people ask, well, where's the demand? Who's asking for it? And it's that classic case when you kind of have to build something to, so, you know, if you think about the 1970s paper crisis on security, which actually was a part of Project Crypto by Commissioner Atkins. In the 1970s, at some point, they had a lot of mergers, and it became really hard to do reconciliation of the securities, the physical stocks. And so what they had to do was they would take Wednesdays off. Now, you know, the exchanges would take Wednesdays off, try to recon. And that also led to securities fraud, thieves just essentially taking that paper and claiming, well, that's mine. It's, you know, so then what they realized that, well, maybe we can digitize these stocks. And so they say this word called dematerialized those stocks, which means that they got all the physical stocks in a room. And then they said, well, let's just now digitize them and then get rid of the physical stocks. So it's actually true proof of burn in the truest sense, right? And then now the tricky part, the interesting part was it did solve that problem then, but it also led to the origination of central limit order books, which is a massive innovation in capital markets. So that tells you that there's a lot of innovation that we might not be able to imagine. But I think that's the kind of, that's the challenge where you first have to play it out. You have to build the infrastructure and then let it spin and see, well, you know, here's five new primitives which come out, which are beneficial to users.
Yeah, that's Jack's job, right? To think of that. It does, I always love to think, you know, of the, you can imagine all the people that, like were caught on video, you know, kind of bad mouthing the internet. Oh, my fax machine works just fine, right? And we look back and see how silly that is. So yeah, you can't help but almost assume that that will be the case going forward. We just can't put our finger on it right now. I guess, guys, when you look at the existing types of assets specifically, we have kind of surprisingly to me, we have private credit, kind of leading the pack in terms of assets under management, and then followed by like money market funds and then kind of everything else. Like we are at the point where experimentation is being done on every asset. Do you have, I guess, maybe an answer as to why private credit in particular is in that spot today, or where you think kind of which specific asset is most impacted here?
Well, personally, my view is that I would love to see more exposure to private markets through this vehicle. I do think when you think about AI and a lot of big companies focused on AI, I think this whole doomsday of, well, is my job going to be replaced by AI? I think you want to make sure that retail and people have exposure to some of those AI products. So, and I'm making this up, but if someone has skin in the game and if they have a token, some kind of exposure to OpenAI or Claude or any of those instances, I think, you know, moving forward in the future, you won't see a lot of resistance to some of these products as well, just because you have some ownership or some exposure to it. I'm personally, I love the idea of private markets just getting more accessible to retail.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about private credit is, I think, higher yields, and we know how much crypto loves their higher yields. And so, like, there's dollar assets, and like, you can obviously go further out a risk curve. And so there's like Dow treasuries that hold originally stable coins, now increasingly on-chain money market funds. And they're just like large pools of idle capital. And now like holding private credit and taking some sort of like, I guess, credit risk on the underlying businesses makes some logical sense. But I also think like people within crypto, like the average crypto user wants exposure to crypto. And like we haven't seen public or private equity on chain take off in a material way. And I think that's because that's a different user base, not entirely, but I think a lot of people within crypto are like, I want to own Bitcoin and ETH. And like, I think, you know, again, not investment advice, use the disclaimer, but like they're super bullish on crypto on a relative basis to traditional assets. And so sure, tokenize public equities and private equity, but they still want to own their Bitcoin and ETH. Whereas, you know, the average person that maybe gets benefits from public and private equities being put on chain isn't using crypto yet.
I think you're spot on about just the customer demand. Like maybe the reason why all of this failed until now was because, well, the customer base was different. You had crypto native people who knew how to use wallets. The wallets were fairly clunky, and they just didn't really value public markets. But now, as it gets more mainstream, and as you see private markets getting more valuable, that's where you see this new customer base thinking about, well, how do I get access to it?
Yeah. Like I said before, my mental model for all of this is that the highest volume, the most liquid assets will find the most success when they become tokenized on chain. And private markets sort of conflicts with that in my head because, you know, we've seen, it's obviously like a lot of people want access to equity in a lot of these private companies. And so maybe tokenizing them and putting them on chain will really be a way to sort of gauge what that actual demand is.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I think going back to Jack's point, do you think one of the kind of core impacts to tokenization is going to be changing the user base specifically? And I guess, how do you view that demand? I guess, do you view it as more sticky and maybe more sustainable? Because I guess, when you refer to the crypto native bunch, it's very pro-cyclical, kind of boom and bust. You're here when the getting's good and you're kind of gone otherwise. How do you view that impacting like the underlying networks?
I mean, I think like technology is good when you don't know that you're using it or you don't know how it works. It's like a lot of people are like, we'll ask a question about crypto and I'll be like, well, do you understand how the internet works? And it's like, no. most people, and that should be how crypto is like you're interfacing, whether you're using it and you don't even know that you're using it, and we're not there yet. And so until we're there yet, like I think finding that user base to connect it back to tokenization is like the users that will hold, you know, traditional assets on chain aren't going to hold them until they don't know that they're holding them on chain is like, I guess the take.
That's concerning to me. But go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think we are seeing big trends in the last few months around a lot of these crypto-focused companies trying to build the super app. And I hate using the word super app, but it's just, it's an app, it's an application where they're good at quite a few things as opposed to just one. But, you know, just backstage, David was telling us about how, you know, one of these firms is coming out with a prediction market on their application-based app on Coinbase, has social media along with crypto and then possibly some lending. But I think it's, to Jack's point, the end user won't care, but it does to the institution that's offering that, they really value those efficiency gains and capturing the margins.
Yeah, I think long term, that's where we end up, where you're using crypto rails and you may not know it. But I think in the more immediate future, it will be more of a story of people accessing assets outside the US that they can't otherwise access. So I think there's just a lot of people out there who want exposure to a bunch of the companies in the Mag 7 and just don't really have a good way to do it. So I think in the more immediate term, that's how we'll see it play out.
Yeah, I agree, David. And I can't help but think that part of the end goal here is to be able to have basically every asset on a single ledger or a single subset of ledgers for your entire portfolio and have kind of democratized access to all of these assets.
When you think about it, it's not... Even if you think about like tokenization of securities, for instance, it's not a hugely massive technological innovation, right? Like when I think about tokenization of precious metals, that is still innovation. But on the security side, it still exists in a database at DTCC. So it's just about change. Like it's an upgrade, but it's not true innovation. So that's the part where I think it, you know, that's probably the path of least resistance. I think the true innovation is when you think about like companies like Paxos or Tether doing like gold-backed products which are tokenized. That is true innovation because that doesn't happen that often. But when you think about just pure securities, it's more of a almost like a technical upgrade, kind of like how we do ETH upgrades.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I think in my mind, like part of the like kind of my cheat way of thinking about this is that a lot of the liquid assets that kind of are high volume anyway are getting that incremental upgrade that Parth mentioned. And maybe, possibly, depending on the reason that they are illiquid, the illiquids may have the most potential innovation ahead of them. Could be proven terribly wrong on that. I don't know what you guys think, but we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue it's like David made the point too. It's like ex-US or emerging and developed. And like in developed countries, accessibility to illiquid asset classes maybe is an unlock. And like that's, I think, more of a relevant trend in developed countries. Whereas, you know, emerging countries literally just getting access to things that we take for granted in the United States, but being able to do it to everybody in an open source way with access to the internet. That's, you know, the near term where we're seeing traction, and I think where we will continue to see real world traction.
Okay. So we'll get to a point, we're assuming here, we're going to get to a point where all of our portfolios are on chain. Okay. Talk to me about the privacy piece, because I don't want you guys seeing what I'm buying and I don't want to see what you're buying. You know what I mean? What role does privacy play?
I think that's the final component which hasn't been solved for, and which is that, how can I ensure that I can just prove that I have access to these securities as opposed to sending you or showing my wallet to you? So I don't think that's been solved for yet. And this is, I teach zero knowledge proofs at Northeastern, so I understand that how important this piece is, but I think it's been, we're far from the place where we can have a truly thriving on-chain economy.
Yeah, I agree with Parth. The privacy is definitely not there yet. Some of these new like stablecoin chains have said that they plan to build privacy into it. So we'll see where we land on that. But I think there's a huge regulatory question around turning privacy on with a lot of this stuff. But it's definitely something that's going to have to be in place if we like really want it to go mainstream. Maybe people want open portfolios and open wallets for like a social aspect. If you want, I can see scenarios where You want people to be able to see what you're up to and have some type of social trading going on.
But that's also like in the context of, I want to know what assets you're like long or short, but not necessarily, I don't think people want to know like what the amounts are, right?
Yeah. So there's like,
today it's all on Etherscan.
Right. So there's a number of ways you could set it up, like not showing the amounts, but showing just the assets themselves. But you know, I do see like a future of like social finance. And I think that, you know, like radical transparency there could be something that people are interested in.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I actually want to pull on that a bit more. I think the amounts is what gets people kind of hyped up, right? We saw the whole Hyperliquid trades all out in the open, and that was getting people a little riled up. So I think there could be a really sticky social component there, David. I'm excited about that.
David, just on that piece, it's not something which will be done for the first time. You have Venmo where you can see, you know, your network and people they're interacting with. And I remember at some point I would get so bored that I would use that as a feed and see, well, you know, what are people up to? It's that piece who loves to look at on-chain wallets. And I realized that, well, you can do that on Venmo too. So I think there's a component to like using social finance.
And it's surprising to me, everybody that I know makes those Venmo transactions public. I keep mine private, but it's out there. So yes, you could be scrolling all day there.
Well, the best way to say is that this exists already without blockchains. And, you know, one of the big brokerage apps out there has recently announced that they're going to add a social component to it. And so you probably can trust that what you're seeing on your feed is true. But I guess doing it on chain would give you, you know, a little bit more confidence if you wanted it.
Awesome. That's all I got, guys. Was there any other final thoughts?
What I'm really excited about is, with tokenization is interoperability, right? I want to be able to take my S&P shares and put them in a DeFi protocol or something like that. I think that's really the big promise here is like actually being able to do something with your assets other than them like sitting in your brokerage account. And there's probably all sorts of DeFi things that we'll come up with.
Yeah, if we're going to do that. What I'm excited about with relation to tokenization is like continuing to evolve the number of like real world use cases that actually have an impact on like more people than just the 1% of people interacting with crypto today, and making use of like the financial primitives that actually do work but are largely built on like circular assets, and bringing real assets on chain and sort of unlocking the 24/7 accessibility, efficiency, transparency, fairness that like blockchain infrastructure brings.
Well, to Jack's point, I'm excited about using Aave and Compound and Uniswap with my tokenized securities and really stress test them.
Awesome. I think I'm excited to finally get to the point where I open an app or I go to a website and I don't have any idea that crypto is underneath. I can pay with my Apple Pay or whatever other options I want, right? And I think that'll be one of the requirements to get over this kind of user demand hurdle. Thank you all so much for listening. I hope you got at least a little bit out of this today. Thank you. And thank you all, gentlemen. This was great.
Thanks. Thank you.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution would or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.